spiritual development. All that we desire to know about our world can be defined as the result of creation and His providence, or as scientists refer to it, as the laws of nature. Humankind, in its inventions, attempts to replicate some details of the creation and to utilize its knowledge of the laws of nature. That is, it tries to replicate the actions of the Creator on a lower level and with more base materials. The depth of humankind's understanding of nature is limited, though the boundary is gradually expanding. Still, to this day, for example, the body of a person is equated to his material body. But such a perspective does not differentiate between people, since the individuality of each person is determined by his spiritual strengths and qualities rather than by the form of his body. Thus, it can be said that all the bodies, irrespective of their multitude, form only one body from the perspective of creation, since there's no individual difference between them which would differentiate one from the other. From this perspective, in order to understand others as well as the entire world around us, and to understand how to relate to what is outside of one's own body, it's enough for a person to look inside himself and to understand the self. In fact, this is the manner in which we behave, since we were created in a way that we grasp that which enters us from the outside, that is, our reactions to outside forces. Thus, if a person does not differ from others spiritually, and all his actions are standard and are within the framework of the variations of the various animal qualities of our material bodies, then it is as if that person does not exist at all. Having no distinct spiritual individuality, it is as if he's part of one common body that represents all our bodies. This can be phrased differently. The only way that a person can differ from another is by the soul. Then if one does not possess this soul, one cannot be said to exist individually. The more spiritual differences one possesses, the more important he is. But if these differences do not exist, then he doesn't exist either. But as soon as the first small spiritual distinction is formed within him, at that moment, that spiritual state is called his birth, because for the first time something individual appears in him, something that differentiates him from the general mass of bodies. Thus, the birth of individuality occurs through the individual spiritual separation from the general mass. Similar to a grain that has been planted, two conflicting processes occur in sequence: the process of decay and the process of growth. There is a complete liberation from the previous prenatal initial form until it is repudiated completely. Until one's physical form is shed, one cannot change from a physical body to a spiritual force. Until all these states are passed, states which are called the procreation of the fruit from above to below, the first spiritual force from below to above cannot be born within him, in order to begin to grow and to reach the level and the form of the one who begot him. Similar processes occur in inorganic, vegetable, animal, and human natures, though they assume different forms. The Kabbalist defines spiritual birth as the first manifestation within the individual of the lowest quality of the lowest spiritual world, the passage of the individual outside the boundaries of our world into the first and the lowest spiritual levels. But unlike a newborn in this world, a spiritual newborn does not die, but continuously develops. A person can begin to comprehend himself only from the moment of self-awareness, but never earlier. For example, we do not remember ourselves in our former states, at the moment of conception, at the moment of birth, and not to mention even earlier states. We only grasp our development, but not our previous forms. However, the Kabbalah describes all the preceding states of creation, beginning from the state of the existence of only the Creator alone, the creation by Him of a general soul, a spiritual being, the gradual descent of the spiritual worlds from the highest to the lowest level, to the last state of the lowest spiritual realm. The Kabbalah does not describe all the following states: how an individual of our world apprehends the lowest level of the spiritual realm, and then his further ascent from the bottom to the top, to one's ultimate goal, the return to the original point of creation. Because the ascent follows the same laws and levels as the descent of the soul, and everyone who seeks to understand must independently experience all these stages of spiritual birth up to the final and complete spiritual level. But having reached, at the end of their growth, the absolute corrected state of their original qualities, all souls returning to the Creator merge with Him into an absolutely indivisible state because of their complete similarity to the extent of their state of non-existence just prior to their creation. In other words, from the moment of one's spiritual birth to one's complete attachment with the Creator, the soul must ascend from the bottom to the top through the same 125 levels that it descended from the top to the bottom, from the Creator to us. In Kabbalah, the first level from the bottom is known as the birth. The last, at the very top, is known as the final correction. And all the levels in between are designated either by names of places or people in the Bible, or by Kabbalistic symbols, the names of Sephirot or worlds. From all the above, it becomes clear that a person is incapable of completely comprehending the creation and himself without fully realizing the goal of creation, the act of creation, and all the stages of development up to the end of correction. Since a person examines the world only from within, he can only explore that part of existence that's perceived by him. Thus, a person cannot attain complete knowledge of himself. Moreover, a person's understanding is limited, because in order to understand an object, generally speaking, one has to explore its negative qualities, and a person's incapable of seeing his own shortcomings. Our nature automatically, independently of our desires, excludes them from our consciousness, because a perception of these shortcomings causes a sense of tremendous pain, and our nature, our body, automatically avoids such feelings and evades them. Only the Kabbalists working on the correction of their nature with the goal of attaining the qualities of the Creator gradually reveal in themselves the shortcomings of their own nature to the degree to which they're capable of correcting themselves. Since these characteristics are always undergoing correction, the uncorrected ones are as if no longer belonging to the individual, and only then will the intellect and the nature of the Kabbalist permit him to see the shortcomings. The fact that a person sees primarily negative qualities in other people does not aid in his self-analysis, because human nature automatically avoids negative sensations. The individual is incapable of transferring onto himself the negative qualities that are evident in other people. Our body will never allow us to perceive in ourselves the same negative aspects. On the contrary, we're able to detect negative qualities in others because it gives us pleasure. Thus, it can be confidently asserted that there's not a single person in this world that knows himself. A Kabbalist, on the other hand, grasps the full scope of a person's nature, of its root, comprehending a person in the primary form, which is the soul. In accordance with the aforesaid, in order to gain a real understanding of creation, one must analyze it from above to below, from Creator to our world, and then from below to above. The path from above to below is called the gradual descent of the soul into our world, or the conception and development of the soul according to an analogy of our own world, the point at which the fetus is conceived in the body of the mother with the seed of the father. Until the last lowest level manifests in a person, a level at which one is completely removed from the Creator, as the fruit of the parents, as a seed which has completely lost its primary form, one cannot become a physically independent organism. But as in our world, so in the spiritual realm, one continues to be completely dependent on the source until, with help of the source, one finally becomes an independent spiritual being. Having just been born spiritually, a person finds himself on a spiritual level which is furthermost removed from the Creator and gradually begins to master the levels of ascent to the Creator. The path from below to above is known as personal comprehension and ascent, in stages of spiritual growth in accordance with the laws of the spiritual realms, just as in our world, a newborn develops in accordance with the laws of this world. The stages of one's growth from below to above precisely correspond to the stages of the soul's descent from the Creator into our world, from above to below. For this reason, the Kabbalah focuses on the descent of the soul, whereas the stages of ascent must be learned independently by each person making this ascent, otherwise he'll not be able to grow spiritually. Hence, under no circumstances should one interfere with one's pupil, nor force upon that pupil any spiritual actions. The latter must be dictated by his own awareness of the surrounding events. Only then will he be able to explore and correct all his qualities. This is also the reason for the prohibition imparted on Kabbalists to share with each other information about their own personal ascents and descents. Because the two paths, from above to below and below to above, are absolutely identical, from comprehending the path from below to above, one can comprehend the path from above to below as well. In this way, in the course of his own development, a person arrives at the understanding of his prenatal state. The program of creation descends into our world from above down. The highest levels beget the lower one, all the way to our world, where it's born in an individual of our world at a particular moment during one of the individual's lives. From that moment, the process reverses and forces him to grow spiritually until he reaches the highest level. But the one who's growing spiritually must put in his own effort as he grows and add his own personal actions into creation for its development and conclusion. These actions consist only of a complete reconstruction of the process of creation, because a person cannot invent something that's absent from nature, whether it's physical or spiritual. In the same way, everything we do is nothing more than ideas and patterns taken from nature. Therefore, the entire path of spiritual development consists only of the aspiration to repeat and reconstruct the spiritual realm that has already been implanted into the spiritual nature by the Creator. As already indicated in the first part of this book, all the creations of this world and all that surrounds them were created in a perfect correspondence to the conditions necessary for each and every kind. As in our world, nature has prepared a secure and appropriate place for the development of offspring, and the coming of the newborn stimulates in the parents the need to take care of it. So in the spiritual world, until the spiritual birth of an individual, everything happens without his knowledge and interference. But as soon as the individual grows up, he's immediately faced with difficulties and discomfort, with the necessity to put forth an effort in order to exist. As one matures, he gradually begins to exhibit a greater number of negative qualities. Similarly, in the spiritual world, with gradual spiritual growth, a person's negative qualities become more and more apparent. The structure is specifically created and prepared by the Creator through nature, both in our world and in the spiritual worlds, in order to bring a person to the necessary level of development, so that he would realize through ceaseless privations that only through loving his neighbor as himself can he attain happiness, since only then he will discover anew the correspondence between the self and the acts of nature from above to below. And so, with everything in which a person finds miscalculations of nature or incompleteness of the Creator, it is precisely with respect to these qualities that a person must complete his own nature, to correct his attitude to the world around, loving everyone and everything outside the self as himself, in accordance with the descent of the spiritual levels from above to below, in which case he'll completely concur with the Creator, and thus will attain the goal of creation, absolute pleasure and good. All this is within our reach, and in no case will the Creator deviate from his own plan, because he designed the plan for us with the will to impart to us absolute pleasure and good. Our task is merely to study the levels of spiritual descent from above to below, and to gain the understanding of how to conduct ourselves in our own ascent from below to above. The seemingly unnatural feeling of love towards others, like us, that's demanded from us, not those close to us, but those like us, because those close to us are already dearly loved, causes in us the feeling of internal contraction of the self, just like any other altruistic feeling or any other denial of egoism. But if an individual is able to relinquish his own personal interest, that is, to contract them, then the spiritual space vacated from egoism can be used to receive the upper light that will act upon the vacuum by filling and expanding. These two actions together are called the pulsation of life, or the soul, and are already able to bring about further actions of contraction and expanding. Only in this manner can the spiritual vessel of a human being receive the light of the Creator, and having expanded his soul, ascend. The contraction can be brought about both by an external force or under the effects of the actions of the internal qualities of the vessel itself. In the case of contraction due to the effects of the painful pressure of an external force, the nature of the vessel prompts it to stimulate within itself the forces to withstand this contraction and to expand, to return to its original condition, and to remove itself from this external pressure. In the case when this contraction is caused by the vessel itself, then the vessel is incapable of expanding to its original state on its own. But if the light of the Creator enters this vessel and fills it, the vessel is then capable to expand to its previous state, and this light is called life. Life itself is the apprehension of the essence of life, which can be achieved only by means of the previous contractions, since a person is unable to surpass the spiritual boundaries in which he was created. A person is able to contract for the first time only under the influence of an external force, or by having prayed to the Creator for the help of the higher spiritual forces, because until one receives the first help, life, into his soul, he's powerless to generate such an unnatural action of the soul. While one depends on the external force and is unable to contract by his own means, one is not considered to be alive, because live nature is defined as having the ability to act independently. The entire creation can be described in an understandable fashion through the concepts found in the Kabbalah. Kabbalah divides everything in creation into two concepts, the light and the vessel. Light is pleasure, the vessel is the desire to receive pleasure. When pleasure enters the desire to receive pleasure, it imparts upon this desire the specific urge to take pleasure in it. In the absence of light, the vessel does not know what it wants to take pleasure in. Thus, the vessel itself is never independent, and only the light dictates the type of pleasure it will receive. That is, the thoughts, the aspirations, and all its qualities. For this reason, the spiritual worth of a vessel and its importance is completely dependent on the light filling it. Moreover, the greater the desire of the vessel to receive pleasure, the coarser it is, because it depends on the light to a greater extent and is less independent. On the other hand, the coarser it is, the greater the pleasure that it can receive. Growth and development depend precisely on great desires. This paradox occurs as a result of the opposing qualities of the light in the vessel. The reward for our spiritual efforts is the recognition of the Creator. But it is ourself that screens the Creator from us. Since it is the desire that determines an individual and not his psychological body, then with the appearance of each new will, it is as if a new individual is born. It is this way that one must understand the concept of the circulation of souls. That is, with each new thought and desire, a person is born anew, because the desire is new. Thus, if the desire of the individual is animalistic, then it's said that one's soul has become enclosed in an animal. But on the other hand, if the desire is elevated, then it is said that the person became a sage. Only in this manner should one understand the circulation of souls. The individual is capable of clearly perceiving within himself how contradictory his own opinions and desires are at various times, as if he were not one, but several different people. But every time a person experiences a certain desire, if these desires are true and strong, that person cannot imagine that there might be another condition completely opposite to the one in which the person finds himself at the moment. This is due to the fact that the soul of a person is eternal, because it's part of the Creator. For this reason, a person imagines that he will remain in any given state forever. But the Creator alters the soul from above, which constitutes the circulation of the souls. Thus, the previous state dies, and a new individual is born. Similarly, in one's spiritual ascents, inspirations and declines, in his joys and depressions, it appears inconceivable to a person that he can shift from one state into the next, finding oneself in the state of spiritual elation. A person cannot imagine how he could be interested in anything other than spiritual growth. As the dead cannot imagine that there is such a state as life, so the living cannot think about death. All this takes place because of the existence of the divine, and hence the eternal nature of our soul. Our entire reality has been especially created in order to distract us from perceiving the spiritual worlds. 1,000 thoughts constantly distract us from our aim, and the more we try to concentrate, the greater the obstacles we experience. The only remedy against all these obstacles is the Creator. This is the purpose of their creation, to turn to the Creator in search of the path for personal salvation. Just as we attempt to distract young children when we try to feed them by telling them fairy tales, so the Creator, in order to lead us to the good, is forced to clothe the altruistic truth into egoistic causes so that we will want to experience the spiritual. Then, having experienced it, we ourselves will want to partake in the spiritual food. The entire path of our rectification is constructed on the principle of uniting with the Creator, of connection with spiritual objects, so as to acquire from them their spiritual qualities. Only while in contact with the spiritual are we able to partake from it. For this reason, it's very important to have a teacher and fellow classmates in pursuit of the same goal. Even in daily contact, unnoticeable for oneself and therefore without being impeded by the body, one can acquire spiritual desires. Notably, the more one strives to be with those who have elevated spiritual goals, the more there's a chance that one will be influenced by their thoughts and desires. Since real effort is considered to be the one that is done against the desires of the body, it's easier to make an effort if there's a set example, and many are doing it, even if it seems unnatural. The majority determines consciousness. Where everyone is naked, as in a sauna or a primitive society, it takes no effort to shed one's clothing. But a group of friends and a teacher are only helpful tools. In the process of spiritual ascent, the Creator will still make certain that a person will be forced to turn for help only to Him. Why is there both a written Torah, the written form of the spiritual laws like the Bible, and an oral one? The answer is simple. The written form gives us the descriptions of spiritual processes that are carried out from above to below. It relays only these processes, though it employs the language of the narrative of historical chronicles and legal documents, the language of prophecy and of Kabbalistic learning. But the main purpose for giving of the spiritual laws is for the spiritual ascent of a person from below to above, to the Creator Himself. And this is an individual path for each person, a path determined by the qualities and particularities of individual souls. Thus, each person comprehends the ascent along the levels of the spiritual realms in his own way. The revelation of the spiritual laws from below to above to the individual is called the oral Torah, because there is neither need nor possibility to give a single version of it to every person. Each one must grasp it individually by praying to the Creator orally. All the efforts expended by us in studying and in working on self-improvement are needed only so that we will realize our helplessness and turn to the Creator for help. But an individual cannot evaluate his own actions and call out to the Creator for help until he feels a need for that help. The more he studies and works on himself, the greater his grievances against the Creator are. Even though ultimately help emanates from the Creator, we will not receive it without praying for it. Thus, the one who wishes to progress forward should exert one's effort in all possible actions, while the one who sits and waits is described as a fool who sits with his arms folded and gnaws at himself. An effort is defined as anything that the individual does against the desires of the body, irrespective of what that action is. For example, if an individual sleeps in spite of the desires of his body, then this too is an effort. But the main problem lies in the fact that an individual always anticipates reward for his effort. But the overcoming of egoism necessitates that one strive to make an effort without being compensated for it. One should therefore ask the Creator for strength to do so, because the body cannot work without a reward. But just as a master who loves his craft thinks only about his craft when he's working, and not about the reward, so one who loves the Creator desires to receive strength so that he can suppress his egoism and be closer to the Creator because the Creator wishes it, and not as a result of the closeness the person will receive. And as a result of the closeness, the person will receive unbounded pleasure. In the case where an individual does not strive for reward, he is constantly happy, because the greater the effort that he can exert with the help of the Creator, the more happiness there is for both himself and for the Creator. In a way, then, an individual is as if constantly rewarded. For this reason, if an individual feels that self-improvement is still very difficult and that no pleasure is derived from it, it's a sign that he has not yet been able to shed his egoism and didn't make the transition from the mass of society to those few in the world who work for the Creator and not for themselves. But the one who feels how difficult it is to make the smallest effort not for his own sake but for the Creator is already midway between the masses and the Kabbalists. The masses, however, cannot be educated properly, because the masses are incapable of accepting the non-evident laws of working without reward. Thus, an education of the masses is built on the foundation of rewarding egoism. For this reason, it's not difficult for them to observe the commandments in the strictest sense, and even to seek additional difficulties. But such a preliminary stage, to be simply a believer, is necessary for everyone. Accordingly, the great Kabbalist Rambam of the 12th century wrote that at first, everyone is taught as little children are taught. That is, by explaining to them that observance should be kept for egoistic benefits, for the reward in the world to come. Then when a few of them grow up, become wiser, and learn the truth from a teacher, they can gradually be taught the methods of departing from egoism. Generally, that which the individual wishes to see as results of his actions is called a reward. The actions themselves can be in absolutely different areas. One cannot work without a reward, but one can alter the reward itself, replace egoistic pleasure for altruistic ones. For example, there's no difference in the pleasure extracted by the child from a toy and the pleasure the adult receives from the spiritual. The difference is only in the outer form of the pleasure, in its garb. But in order to change the form, just as in our world, one has to grow up. Then instead of the desire for a toy, one will have a desire for the spiritual. Thus the egoistic form of desire will be replaced by an altruistic one. It is therefore completely incorrect to maintain, as is done by those who think that the Kabbalah teaches one to abstain from pleasure. It's just the opposite. According to the laws of the Kabbalah, a person who denies himself several kinds of pleasure must bring a sacrifice as a kind of fine to atone for his sin for not using everything that the Creator awarded to human beings. The goal of creation is precisely to delight the souls with absolute pleasure. And such pleasure may be found only in an altruistic form. Kabbalah is given to us so that with its help we can be convinced that it is a necessity to change the external form of our pleasure, so that the truth will seem sweet to us rather than bitter, as it appears at the moment. In the course of our lives, we're forced to alter the external clothing of pleasure, because of our increasing age or because of community. There's no word in our vocabulary to define pleasure. Instead, there are words describing the form, the garb, and the objects from which we receive pleasure, from food, from nature, from a toy. We describe our striving for pleasure according to its type, as in, I like fish. The type of pleasure of those who study Kabbalah can be determined by the question, is it the Kabbalah that's important to the person, or is it the one who gives the Kabbalah? Is the Kabbalah important because it emanates from the Creator, that is, it is the Creator who is important, or is it the observance of the spiritual laws and the reward ensuing from that observance that's the most important thing? The complexity of the entire problem is in the fact that there is a short and easy path to the attainment of the spiritual condition, but our egoism does not allow us to take that path. As a rule, we tend to choose the difficult and torturous path dictated to us by our egoism. We return to the initial point after much suffering, and only then do we follow the correct path. The short and easy path is the path of faith, while the long and difficult one is the path of suffering. But just as it's difficult to choose the path of faith, so it is easy to follow it once one is chosen. An obstacle in the guise of a demand from our own lower intellect, first to comprehend and then to proceed, is called a stumbling block or a stone. Everyone stumbles on that stone. The Kabbalah talks of only one soul, the soul of any one of us, and about that soul's ascent to the final stage. It is said in the Bible that when the arms, or the faith, of Moses, or Moshe, which is a word derived from the verb limshuch, to pull, to take oneself out of egoism, when Moses became weak, he began to lose the battle with the enemies. Those he thought were his enemies were his own egotistical thoughts and desires. Then the elders, his wise thoughts, sat him down, lowered his intellect on a stone above egoism, and raised his arms, or his faith, and put a stone beneath them, or lifted faith above the demands of the egoistic common sense, so that Israel would triumph, or the aspiration of the spiritual ascent. It is also said that the forefathers were idol worshippers, or the initial aspirations of a person are egoistic and are aimed for the benefit of one's own body, and that they were escapees. The word Zion derives from the word Yetzia, which tells us through Yetziot, escape from egoism, the light is received. In the world of a beginner Kabbalist, there are only two states, that of suffering or that of perceiving the Creator. However, until an individual corrects his egoism and can turn all personal thoughts and desires towards the benefit of the Creator, he perceives the world around him only as the source of suffering. But then, having sensed the Creator, he sees that the Creator fills the world with himself, as the entire world consists of corrected spiritual objects. But this picture of the world appears only if one gains spiritual sight. At that point, all former suffering begins to appear as necessary and pleasant, because one has received a correction in the past. Most importantly, an individual must know who is the master of the world and must realize that everything in the world transpires only in accordance with his wishes, despite the fact that the body, with the will of the Creator, continuously professes that everything in the world happens by chance. Yet in spite of the body, an individual must firmly believe that all actions of this world are followed by either punishment or reward. For example, if one suddenly feels a desire to elevate spiritually, he may think that it came by chance. He asked the Creator for help to act properly, but no immediate answer was received. And because of this, he didn't allot enough importance to the first prayer and he forgot about it. But his desire is the reward from his former good deeds, the act of asking the Creator for help to act properly. Or if one declares that at the present stage, when one feels spiritually elevated, there are no other cares in his life except the lofty ones, he must understand that, one, this state is sent by the Creator as an answer to his prayers, and two, that by such an assertion, he proclaims that he's capable of working independently, and his spiritual ascent depends on his own actions rather than on the Creator. Moreover, if during one's studies one suddenly begins to perceive the object of learning, once again he must understand that this is not accidental, but that the Creator sends him such a state. Thus, while studying, a person should place himself in a position of dependence on the will of the Creator, so that one strengthens one's faith in the upper providence. Becoming dependent on the Creator, a person thus forms a bond with him, which eventually will lead to complete attachment to the Creator. There are two opposite forces acting upon a person. The altruistic one, which professes that living the will of the Creator should be the ultimate purpose in this world, all should be for his sake, and the egoistic one, which maintains that everything in this world is created for the human beings and because of them. Although in all cases the higher altruistic force prevails, there exists the long path of suffering. However, there is also a short path, known as the path of the Kabbalah. Every person should voluntarily strive to radically shorten the path and the time for self-correction. Otherwise, involuntarily, one will be forced to accept the path of suffering in order to arrive at the same destination. The Creator will inevitably force one to accept the ways of the Kabbalah. The most natural feeling of a person is love of oneself, which is ultimately epitomized in newborns and children. But no less natural is the feeling of love for another being that's born out of love for oneself. And that produces countless themes for art and poetry. There's no scientific explanation for love and the process that brings it about. In our lives, we've all encountered the natural phenomenon inherent to our lives of mutual love, of the surge of this feeling, and then, oddly, of its decline. Precisely in the case of mutual love, the stronger the feeling, the quicker it passes. Conversely, a faint feeling of one person often spurs a very intense feeling of another, but a sudden return of emotion may very well lessen the original feeling of love. This paradox can be observed in examples of various types of love, love between the sexes, between parents and children, and so on. If one exhibits a great love for another, he doesn't give the other the opportunity to long for him and to love him more intensely. That is, the display of great love does not allow the loved one to respond to the full extent of his feelings, but on the contrary, gradually transforms the feelings of love into hatred. This is due to the fact that the one who is loved stops fearing the loss of the one who loves them, because they experience the eternal unconditional love of the latter. But in our world, where one rarely gets a chance to love another even egotistically, it's not surprising that the feeling of altruistic love is completely foreign and unattainable for us. Since it's precisely this love that is bestowed upon us by the Creator, he conceals his feelings until the time that we develop the qualities needed to answer him with a full and constant reciprocity. As long as the individual feels no love towards himself, he's willing to accept any love. But as soon as one receives the love and is satiated with it, one begins to be more selective and to desire only the feelings of unusually great intensity. And therein lies the possibility of a constant aspiration to increase the strength of one's love for the Creator. An unwavering, constant, mutual love is possible only if it doesn't depend on anything. For this reason, the love of the Creator is concealed from us and is revealed gradually in the consciousness of the Kabbalist to the degree that the latter is able to rid himself of egoism, which is the sole cause for the waning of the feelings of mutual love in our world. It's in order to give us the capacity to expand the boundaries of our own feelings by allowing us to increasingly sense the Creator's unveiling love that we've been created egoists. It's only by sensing the Creator's love, by desiring to unite with Him, that we yearn to be freed of egoism, the common enemy. It can be said that egoism is the third in the triangle of creation, the Creator, we, and egoism, allowing us to choose the Creator. Moreover, the reason for creation, all acts of the Creator, the ultimate goal of creation, and all His actions, irrespective of the way we see them, are formed on the basis of this absolute and constant love. The light that emanates from the Creator, which constructed all the worlds and which creates us, the light, a microdose of which is found in our bodies and constitutes our life, reminds us of what our souls will be after their correction. That light is the feeling of His love. The reason for our creation is a simple desire to create good, a desire to love, to gratify, a simple desire of altruism, and thus it's not understandable for us, a desire that we, the objects of His love, should experience His love in its entirety and find gratification in this, as well as our own feelings of love for Him. Only a simultaneous sensation of these two feelings, so contradictory in our world, awards that complete pleasure that's the goal of the Creator. Our entire nature can be denoted by a single word, egoism. One of the most manifest expressions of egoism is the perception of one's own self. An individual can tolerate anything except the feeling of personal humiliation. In order to avoid humiliation, a person is often ready to die. In all circumstances, be it poverty, defeat, loss, or betrayal, we always attempt and actually do find extraneous causes and reasons beyond our control that are responsible for our condition. Otherwise, we would never be able to exonerate ourselves in our own eyes or in the eyes of others, which our nature will not permit. It will never allow us to humiliate ourselves, because in that way, a part of the creation perceived by us in the form of the self will be destroyed and removed from the world. For this reason, the destruction of egoism by ourselves is impossible and can only be accomplished with the help of the Creator. It can be replaced voluntarily only by elevating the importance of the goal of creation in His eyes above all else. Thank you.